Thanks for the fast blast. The movie that I was just knocking my head against the wall, 1964, Fate is the Hunter, with Glenn Ford and Rod Taylor, about that crash. And it was a great black and white movie, too, by the way. Super. Back in 1947, July 8th, we were faced, those of us who were here, I was not, by the way, I was -3, with a headline in a local newspaper in Roswell, New Mexico, that said RAAF captures flying saucer on ranch in Roswell region. What really happened on that day? We've had all kinds of views on this program. In a moment, another one with Nick Redfern. His views, based on what he believes to be never-before-revealed testimony from military whistleblowers, eyewitness intelligence reports, and an astonishing body of corroborative evidence. Next on Coast to Coast AM. Nick Redfern has been interested in UFOs since 1978. His main area of research centers around determining what has been learned about the UFO subject at an official level in Britain. He has spent hundreds of hours, hundreds, at the Public Record Office in London, and has uncovered thousands of pages of previously classified Royal Air Force, Air Ministry, and Ministry of Defense files on UFOs dating from the Second World War. Nick is the author of several best-selling books on UFOs, including The FBI Files, The FBI UFOs, Top Secrets Exposed, and Cosmic Crashes, The Incredible Story of UFOs That Fell to Earth. Nick also lectures on the UFO subject both in the UK and abroad, and also his new book just out, Body Snatchers in the Desert, The Horrible Truth at the Heart of the Roswell Story. Our guest on Coast to Coast tonight, Nick Redfern. Hi, Nick. How are you?
Hi, George. How's it going?
You have been keeping busy, my friend, haven't you?
Yeah, I tend to follow different areas and different aspects and avenues of research, whether it's UFOs, cryptozoology, conspiracies, and, you know, just kind of look into some of these cases and incidents and see where it all leads. And I guess that's what's happened with the new book.
Let's talk a little bit before we get into the theory behind the book Body Snatchers in the Desert. Can you bring us up to speed on what the official line is, first of all, from 1947? Then let's talk about what others believe happened in 1947, and then eventually we'll get into this dramatic story that you have uncovered.
Okay. Well, surprisingly, for those who aren't aware of it, the government itself was actually offered no less than four explanations for what happened at Roswell. The first explanation was a flying disc, which was then replaced by a weather balloon, but that was both in the summer of 47. 50 years later, in 94, they came up with the Mogul balloon explanation, and Project Mogul was a real project which was designed to monitor for Soviet atomic bomb detonations in the late 1940s. Mm-hmm. And then when people began asking questions, well, what were these bodies? Then in 97, the Air Force came out with a theory that the bodies were actually crash test dummies used in high-altitude parachute experiments. So there have been, I guess, three explanations and then one modified with the parachute test dummies. That one is probably the least credible of all, purely because the crash test dummy experiments didn't even begin until the early 1950s. And, you know, these bodies were designed to replicate the effects on a human being. So they're actually full-sized dummies, 6 feet tall, which looked nothing like the bodies that the people talked about seeing at Roswell. So that was probably the weakest argument of all. But those are the four explanations that the government have offered over the course of the last 50 years.
Well, the one that occurred after the 50s then, do they think we're foolish that we just don't know dates?
Well, you know, this is the thing. I mean, the Air Force came up with this explanation for the crash test dummies when a number of reporters at the press conference, when the story was put out, asked, well, you know, people are talking about 1947, but these tests didn't begin until the 50s. The Air Force came out with this explanation, which they called time compression, where they said everybody had got the dates wrong. Now, my argument would be, if everybody had got the date wrong, surely some people would think they saw something in 49 or 48. It's just weird that everybody would mistake 1953 for the summer of 47.
Now, why do you think four official government explanations, Nick? Why that? Why not just stick with one and just ride it out?
Well, you know, I think the weather balloon explanation doesn't work because there was a high degree of security. And so they had to come up with an explanation that was down to earth, no pun intended.
Really?
but equally could explain the secrecy. And their argument was that Mogul was a classified project and that perhaps with an overinflated degree of Cold War nerves at the time, this led to rash warnings to people that were seen as, you know, really overstepping the mark and warning people not to talk. But, I mean, something we can get into later is I actually found official Mogul records from the same time period where it's quite clear that in these cases there was no secrecy. The material evidence was just forwarded onto what is now Wright-Patterson Air Force Base for inspection with actually the minimum of fuss, and they said, yes, it was Mogul-based, or no, it wasn't. So, you know, and this was only weeks after Roswell, so the idea that these incidents would be treated in a fairly laid-back manner, yet Roswell would be treated completely different, suggests that Roswell didn't involve a Mogul balloon.
See, and it's obvious with these four different governmental stories that there's deception here. There's out-and-out lying to the American people of what happened out there.
Well, you know, I actually agree with you for the most part. I mean, there are some researchers out there actually wonder, and I kind of veer to this area occasionally, not that often, but occasionally, the idea that maybe if this whole story was buried so deeply so many years ago and files were destroyed to hide the truth and protect the guilty, so to speak, if, for the most part, today's government may not actually have a full picture on what happened. They may have, you know, fragments of it and hidden those fragments under these Mogul banners and crash test dummy banners. But I actually wonder if the full and complete picture is actually no longer in anybody's possession, you know, if it actually was, if you like, files were literally shredded years ago to protect, you know, the people involved, so to speak.
Okay, now, so that's the government's version. Four different things, and they're sticking with their last one right now. Who knows if they'll change it five times?
Maybe time travelers, who knows?
Stanton Friedman, Kevin Randall, people who will not agree with your current theory that we're going to talk about tonight, Nick, yet they have their own, as do some other people. Let's talk about that for a moment in terms of what we generally believe happened at Roswell based on what some of these other people have said.
Well, as far as the proponents of the theory that an alien spacecraft came down, obviously, you know, there are some differences between the different explanations based upon the different research teams. You know, some people talk about one crash site, some talk about two or three, some talk about potential collisions between one or two UFOs that actually both proceeded to crash, and, you know, with bodies at one location and some at another. Some people have talked about small bodies with four fingers and no thumbs. Others have talked about almost human-looking 5-foot-tall bodies found at another location. But broadly, the idea or the theory is that one or more alien spacecraft crashed in the New Mexico desert not far from Roswell in the summer of 47 and were retrieved by the U.S. military and taken, you know, to various locations for autopsy and analysis. So that's the, I guess, the UFO researcher angle versus the government angle.
Okay, the experts who had investigated Roswell, talking to some people, I know Stanton talked to some people who were witnesses, and now they have since died off, most of them. But there was an official report by the military that, as you point out, got into a newspaper, went on a radio station there, a local radio station, that they had retrieved a crashed flying saucer. What was that all about?
Well, that's one of the perplexing aspects of this case is, you know, why on earth, if you're hiding anything classified, would you then put out a press release to
like
the world?
That. Exactly.
Drawing attention to it.
And then pull it the next day.
And then pull it the next day. You know, and even if you're using the flying disc story as a cover for something else, then arguably that's still going to draw people's attention, which is the last thing you would want, even if it was a cover story. Now, the story I got, which it might actually be better, you know, to start at the beginning, but the story I actually got was that the Roswell people actually genuinely thought that they were retrieving what may have been a flying disc because they hadn't been briefed on what had really come down. And they actually put the explanation out themselves and then got chewed out because they were compromising a classified project. And then the higher-ups were responsible for putting out the weather balloon cover, if you like.
Well, that's very possible and conceivable. I am perplexed also by some things that occurred, and I can't wait to get to your theories, but the Jesse Marcel, the Undertaker, people like that. So one, we can agree, I think everybody, something crashed out there.
Yeah.
Right? What it was is up for debate.
Yeah, I mean, the thing I would stress to people who may want to read the book is that my scenario actually isn't that different in terms of the fact that bodies were recovered and an unusual vehicle was recovered and was taken to Wright Field and these cover-ups were put into place. The only actual major difference is where the point of origin that I'm suggesting. You know, the actual scenario that I present and that the pro-UFO researchers present on the case actually isn't that dissimilar. It's just, as I said, the origin that's different.
The reports during that time also talked about another crash elsewhere around that same time period.
Yeah, there's actually, if you look at the literature, and this is something I discuss in the book in a way that hopefully explains this. If you look in the literature, there were a number of crash reports from the summer, from the summer of 47 in New Mexico. All sort of broadly in aerospace terms, in relatively close proximity to each other, you know, 50, 100 miles away, people saying, well, there were two bodies at this location, or three here, or four there. And what my evidence suggests was that these accounts weren't confabulated or lies or just created stories, that people were actually talking about three or four incidents and experiments that were undertaken, seeing them from their own perspectives, and then people assume that they're all actually related to Roswell, when in actual fact there was four or five, possibly six or seven experiments undertaken from May to 47 that collectively have become part of the Roswell legend, if you like.
Do you believe that some of the people who attended the crash site while looking at some of the remains of the bodies and of the vehicle in question, or the object in question, truly at that point thought maybe this is a crashed flying saucer?
Yes, I absolutely do believe that. I think that there's no doubt that some of the people at the recovery sites and who saw these things weren't briefed on what it was they were recovering and seeing, and earnestly and honestly did believe that this was something from somewhere else, and that hypothesis or belief actually worked well in hiding what it really was, as I believe it to be, based on the interviews I've done.
Well, that's pretty dramatic. The fact that, you know, you and some of the others are now believing that something happened, though you're going to explain to us that is a little different than what most people assumed happened, pretty dramatic.
Yeah, I mean, the thing I want to stress is, you know, I haven't become, by any stretch of the imagination, a debunker. You know, I feel that when it comes to cases like this, that it's kind of the onus is upon us, those of us that write about the subject and research it and put the information out to the public, etc. The onus is on us to try and do it in a non-biased fashion. You know, we're all guilty of having belief systems. You know, we wouldn't be human if we didn't. But I think, you know, if we can, we need to try and look at these cases with an open mind and not try and get too carried away with people wanting it to be this theory or that theory and just look where the evidence leads. And that's what I really tried to do, was just, when I first got the strands of this story, was think, well, wow, you know, this could potentially be groundbreaking, but if it goes in one direction, fine, I'll follow that. If it goes in another direction, I'll follow that. And, you know, then it was a case of putting the strands together and then coming to the conclusion that I came to.
Can you imagine, Nick, what it was like in Roswell when that crash occurred, what the people in the town might have been saying? I bet they were going crazy.
Sure. I'm quite sure, you know, rumors are flying all over the place. And before the official stamp of secrecy really came down, you know, I'm sure that some of these tales were told, you know, about strange bodies in the desert and weird flying contraptions that came down. I'm sure, you know, that some of the stories people are just going to go to the graves with them. We'll just never get them. You know, I'm pretty, you know, I don't for one moment think that we've got the complete picture. I think, you know, we've got fragments, which in some ways is more credible because, you know, it's, you're not talking about witnesses that sound like they're telling a coached story, you know, to push you down one path. They're all telling little snippets with their own unique angles.
And indeed, the mortician was told, get a couple of coffins, right? Three coffins?
Yeah, and again, that's one of the things, you know, talking about before. He was talking about a specific set of bodies. Other people said, you know, another location, they saw five or two, which to me was, and as I get into in the book, an indicator that there was more than actually one incident that collectively have become known as the Roswell incident.
This crash of the vehicle we're going to talk about right after the break.
Okay.
Because I want to get to this now. Have there been other reports of crashes like that, specifically what we're going to be talking about?
Yes. Well, basically the story I got was that we're talking about sort of fairly diabolic and dubious human experiments, high-altitude balloon exposure tests and prototype aircraft flights using prisoners of war in sort of fairly dubious experiments. And it seems from May to August 47, there was a range of tests in New Mexico. But the key event, there was one key event that kind of led to the Roswell legend, but there were these incidental incidents around the outskirts, if you like, that led to some of the other rumors and some of the other stories that have become intermingled in the main legend.
Who would have been the prisoners of war, Nick? You know, the war was over 2 years later.
Well, actually, yeah, this is why it gets very controversial.
Before that, yeah.
Yeah, it goes back to the Second World War, and two particular units of the Japanese military, one that was responsible for launching something called Fugo balloons, and one, a unit called Unit 731, which did sort of fairly diabolical or very diabolical research on human beings. And basically what happened was that the Fugo balloons were these fairly simple devices. They were just 30-foot diameter balloons with bombs attached to them that would have a calibration device attached, and they were flown across the Pacific by the Pacific winds to the United States.
Hoping they would hit here, right?
Hoping they would hit here. They were calibrated so that over time they would get lower and lower in the sky, and then hopefully the plan was that they would land, you know, on U.S. soil, and if they exploded on the West Coast, potentially, you know, they would start forest fires on a massive scale or, you know, worse still, kill people. And these launches were made from the latter part of 44 through August 45, when Japan surrendered after the atomic bombs were used on Japan.
How many did they try to send our way?
Oh, wow, they sent literally, you know, hundreds and hundreds of these things. And the government actually asked the entire U.S. press not to talk about these incidents because they wanted to get across to the Japanese the idea that these incidents had failed, that none had actually landed.
Did any land?
Yeah, they did, and a few people, unfortunately, were killed, and it was usually because somebody found this unusual balloon debris.
And touched it, and boom, it just exploded.
On the devices and, you know, blew themselves up. But for the most part, you know, there wasn't any publicity given, but the military knew something weird was happening when they started recovering and finding this, you know, these balloon debris scattered in various locations. And then they kind of put, you know, two and two together and realized that it was the Japanese doing it. But these launches went through right pretty much until the atomic bombing of Japan and Japan's surrender.
All right, stay with us, Nick. We're going to come back and get into your theories about the body snatchers in the desert, because it is truly an incredible story. And then you can weigh it for yourself, whether you believe that indeed flying saucers crashed at Roswell, or if Nick's theories are correct, or the other ones that you hear later on. We'll open up the phone lines as well. I'll be back. Now I find out that my line producer, Tom, when he's not answering calls until calls start, has opened up a private request line. on my phone bank. I've been wondering for weeks what he's doing in there and why the phones keep ringing and ringing. And every once in a while, I see him pick it up. And he has been taking requests of these songs, feeding them to my engineers. Unbelievable. Let me tell you about the After Dark newsletter. They're talking about oil. We're talking about energy in the July issue. And we're also talking about Dr. Morgus and what he claims to be his remarkable gas pill. Read all about it by going online at coasttocoastam.com or calling this toll-free number, 1-888-727-5505. 1-888-727-5505. I'll be back in a minute. And welcome back with our guest, Nick Redfern. And now we're going to get into Nick's theories. And somewhere along the line tonight, we'll have to bring up the late Colonel Philip Corso and his theories as well, and some other issues, too, and get Nick's take on all of that. Okay, Nick, so in your research, first of all, tell me how this story started coming to you.
Okay, well, what happened was that in 1998, in my book, The FBI Files, I included a chapter on UFO reports filed with the FBI at the Oak Ridge installation in Tennessee. And in 2001, in the summer of 2001, I gave a lecture in Los Angeles at the local MUFON group. And there was a lady, actually wasn't in attendance at the lecture, but she knew I was doing the lecture and asked if we could meet for breakfast the next morning. And she actually worked at Oak Ridge in the late 1940s. And she told me that she read the book, and I assumed or presumed that she wanted to talk about the sightings that were in the book, that she knew some of the people involved or the cases, etc. But it actually turned out that she wanted to talk about something completely different, and that being the Roswell story. And she said, you know, that you're looking down the wrong path when you're looking for the answers to this particular case. And I asked her to expand on what she meant, and basically, eventually she opened up and said that she actually seen some of these bodies and seen photographs of others and had seen three and knew of 15 that had been utilized in various experiments in the summer of 47. And she said that these were Japanese prisoners of war brought over and people from this fairly diabolical Unit 731 research laboratories and being used as basically guinea pigs in some of these experiments, and that the, quote, alien body angle was introduced as a cover to hide these human rights abuses, I guess, kind of similar to the human experiment radiation scandal that surfaced in the mid-1990s under the Clinton administration.
How bad were these bodies?
Well, you know, this is the thing. I mentioned about the Fugo balloons. At the same time that this was being undertaken, the Unit 731 project was doing all sorts of genuine atrocities, like exposing people to freezing temperatures and high temperatures and the effects of low and high pressures, and, you know, just to determine the effects on the bloodstream and the brain, literally amputating limbs and just reattaching them to someone else to see what effect it would have, you know, kind of.
Sounds like Joseph Mengele, that kind of thing.
That's exactly what it was like. They were doing experiments on twins and handicapped people. And the story I got was that at least some of these people were brought back to the States because, right or wrong, they wanted to see what effect these experiments had had on these people. This also included injection of plagues in Japan by Unit 731 and, you know, just exposing people to bacteriological warfare, that sort of thing. And the story expanded that when the Fugo balloon raids were occurring in the late stages of the Second World War, had the war continued, the Fugo people were working with the Unit 731 people, where they would have these bigger balloons, where they would have a gondola below them with a crew of Japanese personnel who would be responsible for flying towards the United States, and then when they reached the mainland, they would disperse bacteriological warfare via this aerosols attached underneath this gondola.
So that was a real plan.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can actually go to newspaper archives. I've got quite a few copies of these, and they're particularly mentioned in the Seattle newspapers of the time, because Seattle was an area that a number of these balloons had come down in, which actually talk about how America had learned that Japan was planning something, quote, to quote them, more ominous, where they would be launching far more advanced balloons with these gondolas below them. And what's particularly interesting is that because weight and size and were a premium in terms of this flight across the Pacific, they actually trained four, quite literally, little men about 5 feet tall to...
And they knew it was a suicide mission, right?
Yeah, there was no way back for these guys.
Yeah.
The plan was that with the Fugo balloons with the bombs, you know, they just landed haphazardly. The plan was to actually have people on board that could unleash these, you know, bioweapons and plagues, etc., over the United States. But what was intriguing is that I was able to verify that in the summer of 45, there were these plans for these huge balloon arrays with these futuristic gondolas below them that would be piloted by a crew of small guys specifically trained for the job, which was the beginnings, if you like, of what happened at Roswell. Now, in 1945, when the war ended, it's a verifiable fact that a whole range of Nazi and German scientists were brought over under the cover of something called Operation Paperclip to work on rocket programs like the V-2. People like Wernher von Braun.
Braun and his group, yeah.
Strughold and people like that. What's less well known, and a lot of the documents actually don't exist anymore, but it's still a verifiable fact, is that similar deals were done with Japanese personnel. Unfortunately, some of the people from Unit 731 and a lot of the aviation experts who were working on the Fugo balloons and some far more advanced projects as well, which come into play in this story. And basically, one of the plans that the Japanese had was to try and take things a step further. Obviously, with these huge balloons with a gondola below them, you know, the guys were just limited by where the balloons would take them.
Sure.
But the other plan they had was to construct this huge balloon array below which would be affixed a large flying wing type aircraft that was inspired by the Horton brothers aircraft of the Second World War, sort of very, very advanced aircraft, kind of similar to the, in many ways, to the stealth bomber of today, sort of very swept-back flying wing devices. And the plan was to fly these huge balloon systems very, very high over the Pacific, and then for the crew to be able to detach these flying wings and then hopefully, you know, fly to a location where they would then unleash bacteriological warfare. And the plan, the prime reason for flying them by balloon was to get them really high and hopefully evade the, you know, the early fledgling radar that existed at the time.
Well, I can believe that that kind of warfare, that kind of terrorism was in the works.
Sure.
You know, one would have to assume that they wanted to do something on the mainland here, and they were figuring out how to do it, how to get here.
Yeah, and the story I got from the various interviewees, which range from people from Oak Ridge to Defense Intelligence Agency guys and a couple of guys who worked in psychological warfare branches of the military in the 50s, was that when Japan was taken after the surrender in August 45, what happened was that the plans and blueprints and actually the scientific personnel and even the crew on the first planned flight of one of these aircraft actually all transferred over to the States in a similar fashion to Paperclip. And a test was actually made of this device in the New Mexico desert from the White Sands missile range. And it was quite literally, you know, it was a project that catastrophically went wrong. It was kind of seen as unwieldy and almost fated to fail from the beginning because it was so bizarre. The idea of trying to get this balloon and this Horton-inspired glider below it into the air. Basically, the plan was to kind of like construct an array on the ground where the aircraft would be affixed to it and then the balloons above it, then slowly move the ground-based array out of the way, and then the thing would slowly lift in the air. And the plan was quite literally to have this futuristic looking aircraft with this, with a crew of Japanese personnel actually flying it, just get them back on the ground, because they'd basically been, you know, offered, well, you either work for us or you'll be prosecuted for war crimes.
Now, these were they all deformed, diseased, disfigured people?
No, none of these were deformed at all. These were like the guys trained to fly the gondolas. These were pilots, trained pilots,
okay,
but of literally about 5 feet tall, quite literally little men, because again, space and weight were a premium. And so in this is the key event that seems to have led to Roswell. And what happened was that the plan was literally to get this thing in the air and then just have the aircraft detach and land smoothly at White Sands, and then the balloon array could be recovered at a later date if that just happened to, you know, get carried away as it would.
So when we see reports, and I think we looked at maybe it was Jesse Marcel stooped over a picture of remnants of a balloon, that might have been real, you're saying?
Well, you know, I'll come to that, but there's a possibility of some of that being real. But basically what happened was that the plan was, this was a late afternoon flight, and the plan was to just get the whole system in the air, have the aircraft detach and land, and just see if it was a viable project. And everybody said it was that sort of weird and unwieldy that it was actually cancelled because it just wasn't seen as that viable. And the main reason why America wanted to do this, I was told, was because obviously, you know, the atomic bomb and atomic power was coming to the fore. And the fear was that if, you know, there was a strike on a prominent U.S. airfield and the runways were destroyed, there was no vertical takeoff aircraft use then, and helicopters were even at an early stage. And so they were looking at ways of trying to get aircraft in the air where there was no runway. And this was potentially seen as one way of doing it, having an aircraft lifted vertically by a balloon to a high level.
And again, we're talking about 1940-ish technology, so
yeah, and
they have that kind of mentality then.
Yeah, and they were just trying to look at new and novel ways, and some of these things worked and some didn't, as this one didn't. But what happened was that, actually this is something that some of the UFO proponents about Roswell accept as well, that the whole device got struck by lightning. Now, the balloons, I was told, were polyethylene coated with aluminum, and then the device itself was basically metallic. So it was.
And what was the gas? Was it the heated air, hydrogen, helium? What got it up there?
Well, but yeah, I mean, it was just basically, you know, just like a lighter than air balloon system to get it into the air. Now, there was no explosion as such. I want to stress that. What happened was that it appears to have been the aircraft itself that was struck by lightning, where it was actually affixed to this huge balloon array. And what happened was, what actually happens a lot in New Mexico, even to this day, is that you don't even need bad weather to actually have thunderstorms and lightning in this part of New Mexico quite literally come out of the blue. Even without rain, it's kind of one of the unique weather aspects of that particular area. And the story I got was that when the array was struck by lightning, what happened was that this Horton-inspired device below the balloon system became partly detached with its nose pointing towards the ground and began just wildly spinning out of control. Now, obviously, the plan was to have this thing land at White Sands, and the emergency crews on standby were on the ground there from an organization called the Armed Forces Special Weapons
Project. Again, were there people in the gondola and the plane?
No, there was no gondola with this.
It was just the plane pulling up the plane. Okay.
Yeah, and these were four trained crew members and a pilot, so five altogether.
And they're in the plane?
They're in the plane.
All right.
And what happened was that it became partly detached with its nose spinning to the ground, and obviously the rescue and emergency people were on the ground, not trained to deal with the fact that this was now actually, you know, literally heading quite across New Mexico. And what happened was that at some point the aircraft and at least part of the balloon array became detached from the rest of the balloon array, and the weight of the aircraft brought the part of the system down at one location, and the military got out there that night by the time they secured the area, and literally just secured the area that night with a view to cleaning the entire site up the following morning when the sun rose. And when they actually did that, they found, to their dismay, that what had happened was when the system had come apart, it had ripped part of the outer coating off the aircraft, and one of the crew members had got sucked out. So you had, at the one location that the military had secured, you had the aircraft, a large amount of balloon debris, and four of the crew. Missing was a substantial amount of balloon debris, part of the outer coating of the aircraft, and one body, which apparently was found by Matt Brazel on the Foster Ranch some miles away. And what happened was that when the initial recovery was made, they sent aircraft up, spotter planes, trying to find this remaining material, and quite literally just missed it. And, you know, unfortunately, this was only like 24 hours, 48 hours after, and Brazel found it before they did. And as several of the sources said, if the military had got there first, then, you know, before Brazel did, then the story would never have leaked out. But the fact that he went to the sheriff's office, and in turn the sheriff went to the Roswell base, who in turn, you know, then issued this release, that kind of blew it all wide open. But there actually is interesting testimony suggesting that Brazel didn't just recover this huge field of debris, but actually found decomposing body parts as well.
Yes.
And that was supported by what several of the people told me, that he actually found at some, I think 2 miles from the location where they found the debris, he found this body that had been obviously pulverized because it had just fallen from a great height.
And it would have small.
But it was like 5 feet in a flight suit. It had been out there a while and was decomposing. This was the summer heat of
It would have had the almond-shaped eyes, right?
Yeah.
If oriental, it would have that look.
Yes, and it obviously wasn't, you know, a U.S. Air Force pilot, like a Top Gun type guy or anything like that.
And maybe they had their head shaved.
Yeah, that's actually been put forward, that was a possibility. And the idea was that, you know, he went to the sheriff's office and reported finding this debris. And the story I got as to why Roswell put out this flying disc story and drew attention to it was they actually made inquiries immediately in the vicinity with White Sands and elsewhere and said, look, has anybody lost a huge balloon system, because we found what looks like balloon debris, but on a massive scale. Mm-hmm. It's obviously not a weather balloon. Everybody said, no, we haven't lost anything. And the story I got was that the reason why White Sands said we haven't lost anything was because they were confident at this point that they'd recovered all the materials. And it was only when they actually, the following morning, when they began recovering and piecing everything together at this main crash site, that they realized that there were some components and one body missing. And so then they had to brief the Roswell people, because they got a response from White Sands and elsewhere that nobody was missing anything, because White Sands were confident that they weren't going to compromise anything.
And you remember, Nick, in some of the Roswell cases, that people said that one of the crew apparently was alive. Is it possible some one of them survived?
That is possible. I actually mentioned in the book where one of the people I interviewed, a DIA guy, told me there was talk of survivors in one of the files he read, but he was never able to verify that. This was kind of like a file put together by people on site at the time, but I certainly don't discount that. But what apparently happened was that when the Roswell people got no response from anybody in the area that they lost anything, bear in mind this was only 10 days after the Kenneth Arnold sighting.
Right.
What happened was that they actually said, well, you know, maybe this is actually part of one of those flying discs that everybody's been talking about for the last week or so. And so the story I got was that Roswell, the base, actually took it upon themselves to put this story out. And then when, to White Sands' dismay, they realized that Rancher Brazel has now actually found the one piece of elusive material that they've been looking for them mm-hmm. for the last 24 hours. They realize that Roswell has just compromised a major project at White Sands, and the Defense Department is saying, you know, what are these guys at Roswell doing, putting out a press release saying they found a flying disc? You know, they've just compromised a project at White Sands. And in return, Roswell say, well, you know, we checked with everybody. Nobody lost anything. They told us they didn't lose anything. We felt we were legitimate in putting out a statement.
All right, well, let's ask you a little bit more about that when we come back.